Well, as we heard in the State of the Union address on Tuesday, President Obama is putting a new focus on community colleges to try and improve education. The nonprofit company edX has the same goal, but is trying to make change online. As part of a new series we're starting today called The View from the Top, in which we'll be speaking with leaders of industry, of nonprofits, of governments, of small businesses and startups, of anything really. We're joined today by the head of edX, which is the nation's largest nonprofit provider of massive open online courses, or MOOCs. EdX CEO Anant Agarwal joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Well, explain, first of all, the goal of EdX. What is it that you're trying to do?
We are trying to really revolutionize the world of education. Large numbers of people around the world do not have access to a quality education. And at the same time, education itself has not dramatically improved in quality or in efficiency in a long time. Our aim is to increase access to learning to people all over the world. We partner with some of the best universities in the world, such as MIT, Harvard, Georgetown, Tsinghua from China, and so on. But they offer courses on edX that learners can take for free, no matter where they are in the world. And these are quality courses. At the same time, our partner universities are using these courses on their own campuses to offer a blended model of learning where they combine the online content and tools with in-person education, thereby creating a better experience for students on campus as well.
How is what you're doing, though, different from what any other MOOC provider is doing, MOOC being massive open online courses?
So edX is a leading MOOC provider. We have over 3 million learners from every single country in the world and about 400 courses in virtually every topic in multiple languages. So we're one of the leading providers. At the same time, we focus very heavily on quality and rigor. Our university partners try to offer courses that match the rigor of campus courses. But even more fundamentally, edX is a nonprofit. We are the only nonprofit MOOC provider out there. And we felt it's really important to be a nonprofit, particularly when we are creating technologies that can be extremely transformational to the education system. We've also made our platform open source. So we are the only open source MOOC platform out there, which means that anyone can take our platform and use it to help themselves.
You're a nonprofit, but you've got to develop a revenue stream. Where are you on that at this point? How do you make money so that you're not just receiving injections from Harvard and MIT for years and years?
So, Harvard and MIT and many of our university partners have contributed to edX. Thereby, we haven't had to rely on venture capital money where they would rely or require a return on investment on their capital. So this way, we can be completely mission-focused. At the same time, we do have to be self-sustaining. And in order to be self-sustaining, we need a revenue stream. So we have a flexible set of approaches that we work with our partners in order for both our partners and for edX to be sustaining. Notice these courses are not free for our partners to produce. So one example is verified certificates. So a learner can take a course for free, but they can sign up to get a verified certificate for a small fee, like $50, for example. A second approach is that many countries have adopted open edX, such as China, India, France, the Middle East. And many of these countries come back to edX and they ask us if they can license courses from us. So we get a license fee when we're able to license courses to them.
But when you say verified certificates, who determines what those are worth in the open marketplace? That if you get a verified certificate from edX, what does that even mean for a college or a university or a job that might want to hire you?
So, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And so ultimately, the marketplace will decide what the certificates are worth. And so today, many employers pay extreme attention to MOOC certificates. So, for example, there was a recent study by RTI that showed that 73% of the employers that they surveyed, they look for MOOC signups and MOOC activity on the resumes of their applicants. So they're certainly aware of MOOCs and it takes a part in the decision making. Similarly, many universities pay attention to the MOOC courses learners have taken when they apply to universities. So many of our learners post their verified certificate on edX on the LinkedIn profiles. And we have many examples of learners, more than 100, that have obtained jobs in substantial measure because of the verified certificate that they obtained on a course from one of our universities on edX.
But you also have to deal with the same thing that every MOOC provider has to deal with, which is a lot of people don't complete these courses. In fact, the majority of people who do MOOCs don't end up finishing.
Again, this is how you can play with statistics. So if you look at the total number of learners that simply click on an enroll button to explore a course, on average, I believe we have about 7% of our learners obtaining a certificate. However, if you take a cut across our learners and look at those learners that have indicated that they want to complete the course, so learners that have either signed up for an honor code certificate or signed up for a verified certificate. In that case, particularly for learners that have signed up for a verified certificate and put even a small amount of skin in the game, so to speak, with a small fee, there the pass rates go up to 60%. So certainly for learners that wish to complete, there is a substantial completion rate. And 60% is about the average university completion rate across schools in the United States.
We've been speaking with Anant Agarwal, the CEO of edX, about the rise of MOOCs in higher education. Millions of people around the globe have enrolled in these massive open online courses, and edX is working to drive that number far higher and to fundamentally change higher ed. And Anant, let me ask you about that. What do you think is so broken about the system that needs to be rethought?
Go to anybody in the world today and ask them if our education system is perfect and not broken. I think the person you ask would have to be delusional if they responded that our system is fine as is. Whether you look at the quality of education people are getting, I think we're lacking there. There are skills gaps as people graduate, and the problem is much worse in the developing world. If you look at the efficiency of education, that has been an issue as well, where in the U.S., student debt is at $1 trillion. And so while the education quality may be quite good, if you're simply not able to deliver it with high quality. So I think whether it's cost, whether it's quality and scale, I think we have a lot to do to improve our education system.
You've got people at the institutions that are backing what you're doing who disagree with you. I'm sure that's no surprise to you, but I want to read some of their criticism here. This is from Peter Burgard, who teaches at Harvard, in an interview with The New Yorker, who says, "To me, college education in general is sitting in a classroom with students and preferably with few enough students that you can have a real interaction and really digging into and exploring a knotty topic, a difficult image, a fascinating text, whatever. That's what's exciting. There's a chemistry to it that simply cannot be replicated online." Then there is Woody Flowers, who's a professor at MIT. He says, "In edX's MOOCs, I believe we have a product without a strategy. We should design products that help us improve while also helping schools everywhere. MOOCs do neither." You've got traditional professors, basically, who are saying this new model of MOOCs, whether it's edX or anybody else, isn't as effective as learning in a classroom.
Clearly, you've very carefully selected the professors you've spoken to for some of the quotes. But really, I think when something is as transformative as this, you will get a lot of discussion and debate about how good this is and where it's helping. To the first point, absolutely. If I can get an education where there's three other students in a class and I have a professor, a great professor, all to myself, imagine if I could learn Chinese history from Peter Bowl from Harvard, and three of us have him all to ourselves. Well, what a phenomenal experience. But we all know that that is completely impractical. And so those that can afford it, sure, I think that is great. But the question is, how do we replicate this experience for not 20, not hundreds, but tens of thousands of students? And I think that is our challenge. In the second instance, I think if you talk to a lot of professors across many of our partner universities, they are using the content on campus. I think there's a strong strategy in place where we're working to increase access to education for students around the world. At the same time, today, two out of three MIT undergraduate students are using the edX platform on campus in various ways to improve the campus experience. And so any number of professors will talk about how they're using these courses on campus. As an example, Professor Michael Seema is teaching a solid-state chemistry course at MIT. He's blended the classroom by providing instant feedback through online exercises. Students find that fun and flexible.
So do you think that the better model then is just taking a MOOC all by itself, or the blended model that you're talking about?
So that you can think of three ways of doing things. One is the purely in-person model. Second is the blended model. And third is the purely MOOC or the purely online model. And here, the degrees of introduction of technology increases. So I think the blended model is better, but the online experience can be as good as a in-person experience as well.
I want to ask you one more thing about something that you have talked about that goes even beyond what we're talking about with edX, which is you've talked about the unbundling of education.
If you look at how the world has progressed, if you look at AT&T from the late 70s, when I first came to this country in 1972, I had this pink AT&T phone, and 411 would give me an AT&T operator. Bills came from AT&T. Everything came from AT&T. But today, the whole world of communications is unbundled. My cell phones come from somewhere. My long-distance plans come from somewhere else. AT&T is still a part of it, but it's unbundled. And the beauty of that is the whole field advanced dramatically. I've now gone from a rotund pink phone to every known shape and kind of phone. A dramatic improvement in technology, lowering of cost, huge improvements for consumers and the world. In education, we are still very stovepiped. Each institution in education today has to do everything: research, teaching, healthcare, housing, admissions, credentialing, marketing, the works. It is interesting to imagine what a world might look like where we think as universities, what are our key value adds? What's most important to us? Research, education. And imagine, could we do better if we were to focus on what's really, really important and somehow were to unbundle and enable others to do some of those pieces? And I talk about unbundling in time, function, and content. So let's take unbundling in content. Why should it be the case that a professor who teaches a course writes a textbook, teaches a course, writes the exams, the whole thing? Instead, a blended course is an unbundled course where you might use a MOOC from a professor from another university as a new age textbook. That would be unbundling of content. So we do some of that. Why can't we increase that? Today, why is it that every student has to learn in college when they are 18? Why 4 years? How about unbundling time? Imagine that a student comes into college having done their first year of courses as MOOCs and online, possibly even for free. And they come in and they get credit for those first year of courses. They spend 2 years on campus. And then rather than spending the fourth year on campus, they go outside, get a job, and become continuous learners for the rest of their lives. So a continuous education system like this could solve many problems. It will allow people to get just-in-time education on topics that are on the cutting edge of technology and learn as they need to learn. They might be better able to pay later.
But if you think about the reality of the situation, you've got parents who are just desperate that their kids are able to get jobs right out of school, and taking a risk like that and saying, I'm going to do this non-traditional approach, it's going to be difficult for that kind of thing to catch on because you know the value of a four-year degree at a university.
You know, the interesting, the prototypical type of student that goes to high school and at the age of 18, fresh out of high school, goes into college and completes a college degree in 4 years. Of learners in the United States today, only 25% of learners fall into that category. 75% of people that want to learn are not high schoolers looking for a four-year college. A significant fraction are taking way more than 4 years. More than 60% of learners are dropping out of college with only 2 years of credit, and then they become continuing learners. A significant fraction of learners go to community college and collect units and credits, and then they transfer them into higher ed. So the non-traditional learner is more common by a ratio of 3-to-1 than the prototypical learner that we all have in our minds.
That's Anant Agarwal, the CEO of edX, and we've got more about edX at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jeremy. My pleasure to be here.